Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some useful nuggets that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, no matter how contrary that might seem, just like this nightingale, the bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted you could join me today. I must say, I was very excited to interview today's guest who, like me, believes in food as medicine. Unlike me, though, he has the medical and science background to back those beliefs up. His name is Dr. William Lee, the pioneering doctor and scientist behind the New York Times bestseller Eat to Beat Disease. Now, his new book that's out around now is called Eat to Beat Your Diet, and it reveals the science, some of it very new, behind eating your way to a healthy metabolism. I was blown away by a lot of the information in the book, as I told him when we met to record this interview. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading this book, Eat to Beat Your Diet. I have never read in all my years a book about food and nutrition that made so much sense, plus blew my mind about fat. You know, and you say we have to change our thinking around fat. We have to rethink fat. So do you want to tell us about that bit first and then go into all the nutritional stuff? I mean, brown fat or, you know, the other fat, good fat, bad fat. People talk about these things. But for the first time ever, somebody, you, has said exactly what it all is, and you've made so much sense. So please enlighten our listeners.
Well, thank you for your kind words. And actually, the title of my book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, is in fact a trick title. It's not a diet book. It's actually an anti-diet book that really says how the science of our body, including our fat, teaches us that we don't need to fear our fat, loathe our fat the way that society has conditioned us to, but in fact to respect it and also to tame it. So absolutely, we need to sort of have a rethink about our body fat, metabolism, our food, the relationship that all these aspects have with one another in our daily lives. So let's start with fat.
Yeah, absolutely.
All of us as adults have a very common experience. And I can tell you this happens to me as well. You take a shower in the morning, you step out of the shower and out of the corner of your eye, you see, you see a reflection in the mirror and you can see a lump or a bump that wasn't there before, that doesn't please you. And the next step you do is you step on a scale. And when that number that comes up isn't the number you had hoped for, you sort of start to curse. You curse your fat, you curse your lifestyle. You say you need to go on a diet, you need to start working out. It's, I think, a very common internal dialogue we have with ourselves. And even when we go to the grocery store, the supermarket, you know, the idea of fat provokes revulsion. So you walk by the butcher section, and when you see that big rind of fat around a nice piece of meat, you know, it just sort of automatically goes, ugh, that's not something that I want. However, I want to kind of frame shift people, because as an author, as I'm writing this book, I really wanted to step into my role as a scientist. And as scientists, we always ask about the origins and why. So I wanted to ask, why do we even have fat? What good does it serve? And is there something that we need to appreciate differently based on science that perhaps we hadn't before? That's really how the first part of my book is, really to give us a complete rethink about fat and metabolism. All right. So let me first say that fascinatingly, our fat begins to build in our body while we are still in the womb, while we're still in our mom's womb. So when our mom's egg met our dad's sperm and we formed a little ball of cells that will eventually become the future us, our bodies, the first tissue that forms is our blood vessels, our circulation, because every organ will need the blood supply. Second tissue that forms is our nerves, because every organ is going to need electrical signals that command and tell it what to do. The third tissue that forms, remarkably, is body fat. And body fat forms while we're in the womb as these little cells they're fat cells. They're called adipocytes. Adipose tissue is another word for fat, but adipocyte, site meaning cell, forms like a layer of bubble wrap. You know, when we're packing our things, bubble wrap around our blood vessels. And the reason why is because these little fat cells that are little, they're not fat, they don't look fat, they're not big, actually serve as fuel tanks later in our lives, so that when we eat food and we get the nutrients, the energy into our bloodstream, there is an easy to access place to put the fuel, just like the fuel in your car, the fuel tank in your car. It's a tank that's near the side of the car you can put the hose in. So too, our fat cells are ready in place next to our blood vessels, so that when we eat food, we can actually put the fuel into our fat. Okay, now, what's really interesting about that is that it means that we've actually had fat forming in our bodies before we even had a face that we could stuff with food. So it's already time to separate this idea of food and fat being negative. And this is this idea of fat being elemental. Now, fast forward to 9 months. When we see a lovely, beautiful, healthy baby, and it brings a big smile to our face, it's a chubby baby.
Yeah.
Fat cheeks, big tummy, arms and legs that look fat, like the balloons that the clown twists at the fair, right? And that's when we know there's a happy baby. It makes us feel good. And in fact, if we saw a thin baby with chiseled cheeks like a fashion model, thin arms and long, thin thighs, we would be really concerned. It would actually shock us. And we would say there's something seriously wrong with this baby. And indeed, there would be. So this actually leads us to the new biology of body fat. What does body fat do? There are four things that our normal, healthy fat does that started forming long before we were born. Number one, our fat actually forms a cushion. It's not a layer of blubber, as we might think of in a whale, right? Or a seal. But in fact, it's a cushion. And it's a cushion because if we didn't have fat throughout our body, if we tripped on the rug and fell, our organs might split open because they're pretty delicate. So thank goodness we actually have some cushion. Second, and this is really remarkable, our fat is in fact an organ in our body. When I say organ, I'm saying our fat is an organ like your heart, your pancreas, your spleen, your liver, and your lungs. Now, this is actually quite a startling realization, even for the medical community.
Yeah.
And it's not just any organ. It's actually what we call an endocrine organ, which means that it creates hormones like your thyroid, like your adrenal gland, like your pituitary gland, like your testicles, your ovaries. Our fat is the largest endocrine gland in the body. Now, what does that mean, endocrine? It means that it makes hormones. How many? Well, at least 15 hormones have been discovered naturally made by fat to keep us healthy.
Wow.
Healthy. Let me just say three of them that people might, some people might recognize, some of them might not. There's one hormone, normal hormone, called leptin, made by our healthy body fat. And leptin is sort of like a volume switch for our appetite. I say volume switch as opposed to light switch. Light switch is on or off.
Yeah.
Volume switch is a little higher, a little louder, a little less, a little quieter, softer. And the reason that's important is that when our leptin levels are high, our appetite goes down. When our leptin levels are low, our appetite rises. And this is important because when our appetite is up, when our energy, our fuel tanks are low, our leptin goes low, our appetite goes up, it's time to refuel with food. Just like when you're driving a car and you look at the fuel gauge, it's running low. It's time to pull over to the filling station to load up. That's what leptin does, a very important hormone without which we wouldn't have energy. Two, another hormone. This one is kind of a surprise. It's called adiponectin. People may not have heard of it, but it's made only by fat, all right? And what does adiponectin do? Adiponectin partners with insulin in your body, another hormone that draws energy into our cells so that we actually our metabolism can run off the fuel. Now, if I were to actually, JJ, draw as a doctor, order a vial of your blood to be drawn and sent to the hospital lab for analysis of all of your hormones, thyroid, estrogen,
Yeah.
everything. Okay,
Yeah.
I can tell you that adiponectin would be 1,000 times higher than every other hormone in your body. That's how important it is. 1,000 times higher, it would
Wow.
be elevated at that level. Now, why is it that important? Because without adiponectin, you wouldn't be able to draw energy efficiently into your body. And you need energy to blink, to do this podcast, to be able to walk to the store, to catch an airplane, get on a train. We need energy for everything.
Yeah.
All right. So adiponectin is critical, made by fat so that our metabolism can be revved up, not slowed down. Fat is actually producing a hormone that revs our metabolism, not the other way around. Another
I,
hormone is called resistant.
yeah,
And
no, sorry, I
it,
was just going to say, let's just be clear about that. It's only made in fat.
only made by your fat. Yeah. And if adiponectin is the gas pedal that allows you to accelerate your metabolism by drawing in energy, resistant is another hormone that acts as the brake. Not so fast, not so fast. Slow down a little bit. Just like you're driving on a highway, you need to get into the fast lane. Put the gas pedal down. Your car is much more efficient, goes faster. Now you want to get back, you need to slow down. And that's adiponectin resistant. These are just three of the hormones that are made by healthy fat so that we have enough energy and our metabolism is able to run. Now, that's the hormonal aspect of it. The fourth aspect that is really quite well, the third one is the fuel tank. We talked about the fuel tank already. So we store fuel. The fourth one that's quite surprising of normal healthy fat is our parts of our fat, special kind of fat called brown fat. And I want to just explain to
Please.
everyone what listening or watching what brown fat is. Look, brown fat acts as a space heater, just like the kind we put into our apartment or our homes to keep us warm, a little extra heat. Okay, let me explain about brown fat. Brown fat was originally discovered in animals that hibernate. And it is actually designed to keep animals warm because it has a space heater function. Now, how does actually brown fat work to generate that heat? Well, it has to draw on fuel. And you know, when animals hibernate, they have to stuff their cheeks and fatten up for the winter. And then what happens is that the brown fat during the time the animal's asleep or hibernating, it's drawing on the fuel from the loads of stored energy in the fat to burn down that fat, to burn that fuel so that there's heat. Fast forward to humans. Now, we know that humans have brown fat as well. But brown fat is hard. You cannot see brown fat. It's not wiggly and jiggly, lumpy and bumpy like white fat, we call it. There's brown fat and white fat. White fat is visible. You can see it under your arms. You can see it under your chin. It's the muffin top over your waist. It's in your thighs. It's in your butt. Okay. There's another kind of white fat that's tucked inside the tube of your body called visceral fat, visceral for gut. But brown fat's different because those are all lumpy, bumpy fats, wiggly and jiggly. Brown fat is wafer thin. It's paper thin. And it's not near the surface, so you can't see it. It's close to the bone. It is plastered along your neck, under our breastbone, under our arms, a little bit behind our back, a little bit in our belly. And cold temperature will cause our brown fat to light up to generate heat, but so can eating certain foods. Certain foods will trigger our brown fat. I want to show you, give you an example of this because it's so dramatic. I use this as kind of a demo. If white fat basically stores the energy, brown fat burns it down. How does it burn it down? Think about it like your gas range on your oven. You turn on the clicker, whoosh, the flame goes up, and now you can cook, you boil your water or cook your soup. To get that flame, you have to draw it down from someplace. So think about this. This is the little lighter I use for my fireplace. Imagine this is brown fat. You can eat either cold temperature or eating certain foods like chili peppers and other foods. We can talk about that. Well,
Some of my
actually, you
favorites,
eat it, it'll turn on your flame. It'll burn on, this is actually a flame. And this brown fat actually is burning the flame, and it has to draw the fuel from your white fat. So this is good fat that can fight bad fat by drawing the energy.
So
Powerful. These are the four
very
normal functions of fat.
Absolutely powerful. So you can think of your brown fat as almost being like the wick in a candle burning the oil, or in an oil lamp, in fact, burning the oil as it goes down. Yeah. But also, as you were talking about brown fat and it being, this the fat that ignites when you're subject to cool temperatures. I swim all through the winter in the sea here in Scotland. Now, I've noticed after 2 years of doing this all through the year, I've noticed that when I get into the water, I'm breathing, I'm using my breath, I'm swimming, and I've noticed how almost out of nowhere, I can somehow be generating heat in my body. I might still be feeling the cold on my skin, but my body isn't feeling so cold. So that must be my brown fat.
That's exactly what's happening. So what happens when you get the temperature shock of cold water? Anybody who's, I mean, you must, swimming in the sea in Scotland must be quite chilly, but I will tell you that this happens for anyone who actually takes some people do cold plunges.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
For health reasons. Mm-hmm. What happens is that there's a little bit of a cold shock. It causes your brain to release a hormone called norepinephrine. Norepinephrine, released from your brain, travels down nerves that touch your brown fat, and it turns on, triggers your brown fat to fire up. Brown fat, again, close to the bone, it tries to warm you up. It tries to keep your core temperatures warm.
Yeah.
Right? So that's like a preservation thing. And so exactly how you're feeling. Now, I'll tell you, in addition to cold temperatures, foods can do this. So if you were to eat some spicy sauce, a sriracha, a kimchi, a salsa, Mexican salsa, something really spicy, mm-hmm. An arrabbiata, a spicy Italian sauce, for example.
Yeah. Arrabbiata,
if you were to, arrabbiata, if you actually next time taste it in a dark room, close your eyes and feel your body, you will actually, when you start feeling the zing, that little burn that happens on your tongue, that is the capsaicin in hot chili peppers. And I'll show you, I have a little demo here. That just happened to be at a table. This hot chili pepper, these are chili pepper flakes.
Oh yeah,
that's what you put on a pizza.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, when you actually put that onto your tongue, it turns on a special receptor that is called TRPV1. Don't worry about the scientific names.
Yeah.
But that's basically like a lock and a key, and it turns the key in the lock. And what happens is that your tongue will fire, it will send a text message to your brain. And your brain will release two hormones. One hormone is called an endorphin, which is why some people really love spicy food, perhaps
like
yourself.
Me.
and so you kind of crave it, right?
Yeah.
Because you feel good for it. You get a positive reaction. Now, the other hormone it releases is norepinephrine, the same hormone that cold temperatures are released, except you're not cold, you're eating a spicy food. So next time you're doing this in a room, close your eyes and just pay attention to your body. You will feel the burn, you'll sense the text message to your brain, and then literally you'll feel your nerves lighting up, traveling down your neck and lighting up your brown fat. Now, the norepinephrine, by the way, is what we call a stress hormone. It causes you to sweat. It causes you to vasodilate. Your breathing becomes a little easier because you're dilating everything. This is actually exactly what's happening. And one of the underappreciated beneficial side effects, is that you actually turn on your brown fat that will then begin to burn down fuel from your harmful white fat. So you've got extra fat. Eating spicy food is one of 150 different foods I write about in my book that can help you burn down extra fat.
Eating to burn fat, that's such a pleasing concept to me. I don't know about you. Well, while we're relishing that thought, it's time to take a short break, and I'll be back with Dr. Lee right after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden. Ann and Deck, Fish and Chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest, Dr. William Lee, author of Eat to Beat Your Diet. I asked him just how recent the science is on fats and how different foods can boost our metabolism.
Yeah, you know, I would say it wasn't until about 2009 that we began truly understanding the extent of brown fat in the adult human.
Yeah.
Previously, in the 60s and 70s, we thought maybe there was a little brown fat, we call it vestigial, meaning leftover from evolution, like the appendix or the tonsils, and people just kind of discarded it, like, we don't know what it does. Look, babies are born in warm delivery rooms, and we have incubators, and when you go home, you go to a warm home that's warm by the hearth, it turns out that brown fat actually is just almost invisible. It's thin. So it's kind of a hidden shield for us. It only lights up when we actually need it. But the history is super interesting because it was in the 16th century that naturalists studying hibernating animals in Central Europe discovered this little mass of fat, this little fat in the between the shoulder blades of the alpine marmots. It's in the mountains of Eastern Europe, and they didn't know what it was. Fast forward, they started into the 18th and 19th century. They found it in other hibernating animals like bats and squirrels, etc. And then, if you fast forward that even further, it wasn't until the 1960s that a scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles, and by then in the 60s, we had microscopes that were pretty powerful. He looked at the microscope and said, wow, this is actually fat tissue. The cells are actually fat tissue. And now we have drilled down right to the molecular level, the genetic level, to really begin understanding that this is actually a very powerful part of our body. By the way, and for anybody who's kind of a science geek, I'm a big science geek. So I'm going to share my enthusiasm. Why is brown fat brown?
I don't know. Why is brown fat brown?
Okay, because the fuel cell, that the battery that generates the heat, is called a little piece inside a fat cell called a mitochondria. I used to think of it as mitochondria when I was in medical school. I had to memorize them. But it is small but mighty. It's like a little nuclear fuel cell. And the mitochondria actually is loaded with iron. And iron, when it oxidizes like a nail, is brown or a statue. And it's because there's so many mitochondria packed, so many fuel cells packed into your mitochondria, and it's got so much iron in it. That's why brown fat is brown.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. So a little bit of background helps us better appreciate what we have in our body. I mean, that's the coolest thing, JJ. We're still discovering.
Yeah.
New functions in the human body.
I know. The human body is a wondrous thing, quite frankly. Well, all life is pretty wondrous, but, you know, we don't know. I sometimes think we don't know the half of what goes on in our body still. You know, there's so much still to be found. But getting back to your book and some of the information. Now, I wrote so many notes when I was going through the book, right? So many things just kind of, yeah, great. That's just such a great point. Like You know, fat is essential to life. So we're establishing that right now. We need to rethink fat. Size doesn't necessarily equate to bad health, because fat's more complicated than even we've just been saying right now, isn't it? I mean,
That's right.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, the other thing that we equate with fat is body size, and that's really just wrong. I mean, I think obviously there's a body positivity movement, which is much needed after decades of media brainwashing with sort of this unrealistic physical ideal.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing we need to appreciate is that we are all, as individuals, made of different sizes. And it's okay. We, based on our size, we have our own type of body fat or composition of body fat that is really tailored for to be ideal to each of us as individuals. And the way that I explain this is that let's think about the fittest individuals on the planet. And these are young people who are super fit, and they're Olympic athletes. And if you think about them, each of them have different sizes. All of them are in exceptional, extraordinary shape and fitness. You have the tiny little gymnast. Mm-hmm. You have the javelin thrower, tall and lanky. You've got the weightlifter who's big and thick, and the big wrestlers. All of them are at the peak of their fitness.
Yeah. Even
and
sumos, yet they have even sumo wrestlers, right? Huge
That's right.
sumo wrestlers. They're fit.
They're very fit. And so this is basically why we can't just simply equate body size with unhealth or with being lack of healthy. Body size is very personal, and it's really the kind of fat and the location of the fat and how else you live and eat. You know, health is actually quite invisible. It's the healthy inside that leads to the healthy outside. And so much of our efforts, you know, we're in a fat crazed, obsessed society where everybody's going after prescription drugs, or, you know, the latest craze is sucking out the fat from your cheeks, called buccal surgery. I mean, you know, these are really disfiguring, or the medicines are really, you know, to me, the medicines that block appetite that are in such craze. They're diabetes medicines, but they've been found to block the appetite in your brain, thereby removing the pleasure of food.
Yeah.
The pleasure of food is so much part of our humanity that's a big deprivation to me. So, you know, what I write about is the fact that by having a better understanding of body size, body fat, and the relationship with food, we can reorient the pieces to be much more pleasurable, much more natural to us, where we can eat not to pursue what we see in the mirror, but we can eat to really pursue our inner health, which then will, of course, lead to a better outer shape. I have no problem with vanity. I mean, if you feel good by looking good, however you define looking good, please make reasonable efforts to. I mean, that's important. That's your self-identity. Very important. But on the other hand, that inner health, I mean, you don't want to be doing that first part at the expense of your inner health. And inner health is important for our long-term vitality, for our longevity, and to really help us avoid chronic diseases. I'll tell you another example of body size and body weight. If you think about the sport boxing, you know, the pugilistic sport, there are 14 different weight classes. You have everything from flyweight, you know, which is like 110 or 100, very, very lightweight people, to heavyweights, you know, the big guys who are, you know, 250 pounds or more. And yet within each weight class, there is a world champion in every single group. These people are fit. They work out, they train, they eat very healthy. You know, they are subjected to enormous amounts of exercise and discipline. And so this is why I think we need to step back from thinking about simply body size as equating to health or healthy weight. Look, I'm a doctor, and I've told plenty of people based on the weight on their scale and body size, this is a knee jerk among physicians, you know, that if you see somebody who has a big body size, you know, you start to give them the lecture about you must lose some weight without giving them any concrete method to do it.
Right.
And I think what we need to do is to really take the time in the medical community to understand and personalize our advice to people so it doesn't become one size fits all, literally.
Yeah. It's great that you are promoting that, because I think it's important for people to understand, because a lot of body shaming goes on, right? There's a lot of people who just feel terrible because, not because they feel particularly terrible, but because they see other people, hear other people telling them that they're overweight and they need to do something about their weight. Yeah, I get that. And you talk about benefits that can come from losing not very much weight at all. In fact, you talk about different levels of losing weight. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So most people believe that they have to lose a lot of weight to gain benefits. But it turns out that even losing small amounts of weight can have tremendous benefits. There's benefits from losing just 1 to 2 pounds, yeah, or 2 to 4 pounds, or 5 to 7 pounds, or 7 pounds, or 10 pounds or more. So the more weight you lose, the more benefits you get. But people might be surprised by, you know, just losing 5 pounds, you decrease the risk of breast cancer by about 18%. All right. 5 pounds decreasing almost 20% of risk of breast cancer, to me, is stunning.
It
now,
is.
The reason that's important is because if you focus on losing 20 or 25 pounds, and to do that, you want to jump into an extreme diet or some craze that is built on elimination or restriction, you're going against human nature. Human nature abhors deprivation. So when you say you cannot do something, you must eliminate something, you know, or you're a bad person for eating this or eating that. What happens is that our brains automatically tell us, I think, where it's just our nature,
yeah,
say, well, if I'm being deprived, maybe I'll do just a little bit. And you eventually you can no longer hold on to that,
correct,
discipline.
Yeah.
And you rebound, gain it all back. And then you go to the next extreme diet that you can't maintain. So what I say is the science tells us that, I mean, and by the way, we're talking about breast cancer, endometrial cancer, cancer of the uterus. You're talking about heart disease, heart failure. I mean, all these things you can eliminate, dramatically reduce the risk by losing less than 10 pounds. That is readily achievable. And furthermore, if you can lose less than 10 pounds by doing two simple things, and this is my point, is that it doesn't have to be extreme or difficult. One is just sort of regulate when you eat and how much you eat. That's one thing. The second is just making better choices, substituting things that are going to cause you to gain weight with delicious things that are going to actually help you fight weight. Those two things alone, which anybody can actually do. And that's what I write about is, and you can personalize it to yourself, will make it possible for you to not have to go on a diet again in your life.
Yeah. Yes. And I think I said before we started recording this, that virtually everything that you have on your list of good things to eat are some of my favorite things to eat. You know, I just love all the things that you are talking about, and you go through everything, let's just say, and you make it very clear that these aren't things that you might have to pay an arm and a leg for in the supermarket. These are things that you'll find in everyday stores that won't cost you a fortune, that you can make delicious food with. So maybe this is a good point to start, just talk a little bit about the food, right? What foods should we be looking at? And talk about your Mediterranean diet that you that you follow, and also a little bit about intermittent fasting as well.
Sure. Well, let's go right into the food. So
yeah,
in the middle part of my book, I write about the second part of my book, I write about which foods can help your metabolism by burning down body fat, turning on your brown fat to burn down white fat, and in fact opposing white fat at all. Ironically, and this is somewhat paradoxical, the research has shown that there are certain foods you can eat, put into your body, consume, that actually help to fight fat. Previously, I had thought, before I did all this research, that you eat food, you're going to gain weight. You're not going to, there's not food,
yeah,
that's going to fight fat. But
yeah,
the great paradox is that you can eat food to lose weight. And so, and they're delicious.
Again, eating to lose weight. Like Dr. Lee, I thought you just always gained weight the more you ate. Well, time for another short break right now, but Dr. Lee will be back to explain more after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory, E bar gold.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 on UK Health Radio and the UK Health Radio podcast with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and today's guest, Dr. William Lee, who has a lot more to say about the everyday foods that can boost our metabolism.
The way I wrote my book, the second part of my book, I wrote it keeping the reader in mind as if you were just riding in the shopping cart like of your mother, like you did when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And I was pushing the cart through the grocery store, pointing out, whispering in your ear what you should actually put in the cart that can help your metabolism fight body fat. So through the produce section, I talk about all kinds of foods like tomatoes and avocados and broccoli and bok choy and broccolini and broccoli rabe. We have red onions. We've got all sorts of mushrooms that I love to eat. We have chard. We have carrots. Just the numerous turmeric, the turmeric root, mm-hmm. numerous foods that are good. And those are, you know, that doesn't start to even get into the fruits, the apple, the pear, the citrus, the strawberries, the blueberries, mangoes, the watermelon. These are not terribly exotic. Kiwi. These are foods that we can actually find in almost any modern grocery store. And because there's such diversity, not only do we know that these are plant-based foods that are good for us, leafy greens, antioxidants, and so on and so forth, but now we know that eating these, when prepared in the right way, can activate our metabolism and burn down body fat by turning on our brown fat. Again, you know, that space heater function that allows our fuel to turn on. Okay. Now, then I turned the cart into the forbidden middle aisles of the grocery store. Remember how just a few years ago, everybody said, shop only the perimeter, avoid the middle aisles. It's very dangerous in there.
Yeah.
And when I have a whole chapter, I call it treasure hunt when you go into the middle aisle. Because like a treasure hunt, I try to tell people, yes, there's a lot of fool's gold on the shelves. So don't be mistaken by picking fool's gold in your cart. But here, there's also real gold, genuine gold, that helps your metabolism to fight body fat. So things like lentils and beans and tree nuts like walnuts and almonds and pecans and macadamias, things like dark chocolate, cacao, dried chili peppers, dried mushrooms, tomato paste, canned tomatoes, and of course, tinned seafood, which, you know, in America, I grew up in America and we used to think of tuna, cans of tuna fish as sort of like cat food, you know.
Really?
Well, it smells like cat food. It looks like cat food.
Yeah,
but it turns out that in Europe, right? I mean, you know, this is Spain, Italy, Greece, but especially Spain and France and Italy, conservas. These are the tinned, delicious tinned seafoods, whether it's mackerel, sardines, octopus, razor clams, tiny little clams that are Absolutely delicious.
Beautiful, lovely little tiny clams that you get in France. I can't remember what they're called, but beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. And these are tins that you find in the middle aisle.
Yeah.
You can also find, by the way, in the refrigerated section nowadays, the kimchis, the sauerkrauts, the yogurts. All of these actually contribute to burning down harmful fat and turning on good fat. I also take people by seafood. Before we started taping, we were talking about different types of seafood that we enjoy.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, in the middle aisle, I forgot to mention capers.
Of course.
You know,
we love capers here. And I was telling you that I'd had seafood with capers for lunch with broccoli, which is another one of your, you know, foods.
You know, the capers, by the way, for all these foods, including capers, research is now beginning to identify the exact substance in each food that can help burn fat. Capers have something called quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. Quercetin is found in really high amounts in this tiny little flavor bomb called the caper. I mean, capers are piquant, lemony, sharp, make anything tastier. I had capers last night for dinner myself.
Oh, did you?
the thing that is amazing is that quercetin is also found in onions, but capers have 66 times more quercetin than a big onion does.
Good heavens.
This tiny little caper.
Wow.
So small but mighty, right? Mm-hmm. So for all these foods I'm mentioning, we know what these are, but the seafood section I think is really remarkable. Most people used to believe that you actually had to have very oily fish only if you wanted to get the benefits of seafood.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's what we were taught. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, that turns out not to be true. The new research actually shows that, and I read about this in a book, that true oily fish like salmon, like mackerel, sardines, anchovies, do contain abundant, healthy omega-3 fatty acids. We know that's a healthy fat that can, and not only is it good for your heart health and brain health, not only does it reduce the risk of cancer, but we now know that it actually turns on your brown fat to burn down white fat. It actually helps improve your metabolism. So, amazing study from the University of Iceland showed that they wanted to say, how much fat can salmon burn off? How much weight can you lose from eating salmon? Well, what they found is they put this group of people onto an 8-week clinical study where they had a small reduction in their calories. All right. So they were, and then they said, if you add salmon on top of that, would it speed it up, right? So it's a clinical trial. And they found by having these people eat salmon 3 times a week over 8 weeks with a little bit of calorie restriction, they could lose 15 pounds in 8 weeks, which is quite a lot.
That is
okay.
A lot.
That's the only thing that they did. Now, salmon has 1,565 milligrams of omega-3 per 5-ounce serving. So it's really very dense. And you would think, oh, man. Okay, I got to eat that much omega-3. Mm-hmm. I have to have that super quantity. Well, they had a different group that they thought was going to prove that less oily fish aren't going to work. So they used cod, which is a flaky, white, very mild fish.
Yeah.
Cod only has 284 milligrams per serving compared to 1,565 for salmon. So it has almost seven times less omega-3s. You would think it doesn't work, but when done in the same way, in the same experiment for 8 weeks, 3 times a week, people who ate cod lost 10 pounds.
That's not
bad. In 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Not bad, right?
Yeah.
So what it shows us is that, of course, salmon ate lost more. What this shows us is that we don't need the oiliest of oily fish.
Right.
So in my chapter, I start to celebrate the fact that if the amount of omega-3s in cod are enough, well, then we can start to rejoice in other seafood that has equivalent amounts of omega-3, and I calculate the dose for you. So if you want the same amount of omega-3s in a serving of cod that would lose 10 pounds over 8 weeks eaten 3 times a week, then all you have to do is, I put this on a daily basis so people can understand,
you only need
4 medium-sized shrimp, okay, or langoustines, or 8 oysters, or if you want to have an oily fish, one forkful of mackerel
wow.
is all you need. You don't need to eat the whole fillet. One forkful will give you the same amount as a serving of cod. Halibut, another mild fish. You only need to eat a piece of fish half the size of a deck of cards in order to get the amount you would get in cod. So again, I talk about shellfish. I talk about crustaceans. Yeah. I talk about all kinds of different fish. I know not everyone likes seafood, but I always tell people, if you are not certain of seafood or you don't like seafood, don't worry. You just haven't had it properly prepared yet. So find somebody that does it really well and you're going to love it.
I think that's right. And also, I think it's a challenge for people in some places, some areas, to find fresh seafood, fresh fish and fresh seafood. Where I live right now, you get nothing but. I mean, we are so blessed here for fresh seafood. But, you know, in the cities, you know, you go to a supermarket and maybe it doesn't look that appetizing. And always I say to people, if it smells, you don't buy it, because fish should not smell of fish.
Always look at the origin and how it's actually handled before it makes its way to you. But, you know, one of the things, JJ, to actually point out is that oftentimes frozen seafood, when properly caught and frozen on the boat and sent to the store, can be as fresh in some ways than the one that was actually flown by an airplane to the market. So I think that, you know, there's a lot to potentially explore, but not to be turned off. As I once was, that, oh, you only need to eat anchovies or mackerel or sardines. Like, I don't mind those, but they're not my favorite fish. But now that I realize that there's a whole world to explore.
So
back to this whole concept of Mediterranean. Look, I'm always asked what kind of diet I'm on because I study food as medicine. And I respond, honestly, I'm not on a diet. But I don't believe in diets myself, but I understand some people who go on them. But I do have a way of eating. So I don't diet, but I have an approach. And my approach I call Mediterranean, because my background is Asian. I grew up Asian, home-cooked Asian food. I've spent lots of time traveling and living in Asia. And I also spent time in the Mediterranean. When I did a gap year before I went to medical school to become a doctor. And I lived in Italy and I lived in Greece. And while there, I studied food, health, and culture because I was very interested in them. So literally, I walk the walk in addition to talk the talk. And when I go out to shop, or I sit down at a restaurant to look at the menu, or if I'm, you know, at a spread of food, I'm looking at what's being served, I naturally gravitate towards ingredients and preparations that either come from the traditional culinary backgrounds of the Mediterranean or Asia. Both of those, by the way, are the healthiest food culture, traditional food cultures in the world.
It's true.
And they're actually not just something new that I practice this day. I mean, I've been living this way for decades, but it turns out that 2,000 years ago, the Mediterranean and Asia was connected by the Silk Road, which is the most, the greatest trading route in human history, connected China to Europe. And it went through the Eurasia. And back then, traders on camelback exchanged recipes, ingredients, cooked for each other. And so there is a long hallowed tradition of these types of ingredients and the exchange of cuisines. It's not just modern fusion food. It's really quite traditional. And so I think as we realize, you know, it's very hard to invent a new food that can do something better than something that was done in the past, you know.
Absolutely.
And so we can go back to our traditions and therefore find something that we all enjoy.
Absolutely. And that's very important, enjoyment. And I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. There is so much more I wanted to talk with you about, but we've come to the end of our time for now. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to persuade you to come and give it another go another time and have another chat with me, but there's so much more, the gut biome, all the different things that you talk about as well in your book, which is remind us of when that's being published here in the UK and elsewhere.
The book is going to be released in the United Kingdom on March 21st.
Yeah.
So then it'll be available everywhere and also the United States. I really want people to realize that this is an opportunity. I wrote this book because I truly believe in science and I truly believe in health. But the third thing I truly believe is really enjoying our food. I'm kind of a foodie. I like to cook myself. I truly appreciate the tradition, the culinary traditions of the world. We all come from somewhere and we have our roots. Everyone can remember something that their mom cooked when they were growing up that just makes them feel good and comfortable. And I want people to go back and recognize that in many cases, the science teaches us the thing that we actually love can be good for us. And there's just little tips that allow us to actually eat them in ways that help our body improve our metabolism.
I love it. I love it. You're a man after my own heart as well when it comes to food, I think. But for now, thank you so, so much for coming on the show and talking about it. I would love for you to come back another time if you can find the time. I know you're going to be very busy with the book coming out. But if we can come back another time and talk more about all these other issues, gut biome, that sort of thing, how does that fit into it all? But seriously, once again, I think that your book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, is a stunner. Basically, it's just fantastic. I love it as well when I see these things come out, which make so much sense. And you make it so easy to understand, even though you really do go into the science. So thank you so, so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Brilliant. So do watch this space for part two with Dr. William Lee, author of the new book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, a book that will change the way you think about fat forever, I promise you. Meanwhile, sadly, we're at the end of the show. I hope you'll join me here on Alchemy 101 and UK Health Radio again for more from Dr. Lee and a host of other wonderful guests. If you're listening to the podcast version of this show and you like what you hear, do subscribe and share this episode. It would be fantastic if you could leave a review too. Talking of subscriptions, why not subscribe to our sister publication, Health Triangle magazine, for even more health and well-being news and information? That's at ukhealthradio.com/magazine. And I mustn't forget to mention the show that I co-host with Dr. Mark Goulston here on UK Health Radio called Hurt Less, Live More. Tune in there for weekly open and often raw but uplifting conversations. So I hope you'll tune in again sometime soon. But for now, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.